the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. My name's Anne-Marie Sheedy. I am CRO at ExchangeWire and I'm delighted to be hosting this week's podcast. Today, I'm joined in person, which is fantastic, by Andy Stephen, Managing Director UK, Retail Media, Criteo. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And of course, I'm also delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire's CEO, Rachel Smith. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Anne-Marie Patricia Sheedy. Sorry, listeners, had to do it. I only ever refer to Anne-Marie as AMS. That's her nickname. And if ever I say Anne-Marie, it feels like I'm chastising her. And so I have to use her full name as though I was the primary school teacher.
Yeah, that's really set me up for a great podcast now. I'm going to go, what have I done?
I'll take note of that.
Yeah. Feel free to call her AMS on my behalf, on anyone else's behalf. That's absolutely acceptable.
Australians abbreviating things. Yeah. Anyway, we'll crack on. So we've got three really interesting stories today. The first one is looking at some of the issues hindering retail media efforts. So despite being touted as the next big thing for digital marketing, retail media is providing a tricky space for some marketers. Almost half of US marketers, and that's 47%, say that new data and privacy regulation is impeding their ability to develop their retail media arms. 30% state that the structure of their organization is not conducive to sharing insights and data effectively, with over a third reporting an absence of standardized measurement metrics. Over a third of marketers, so 37%, report that their retail media partners are neglecting to help them overcome key challenges. That third are also saying they don't trust the accuracy of the data from some retail media partners. 34% say they don't trust the quality of the data coming from partners. Having said all that, despite those numbers, retail media is still expected to grow 31.4% to over $40 billion US dollars by the end of 2022. Right, there's a lot of numbers in there. There's a lot of information that I'm sure you're going to maybe challenge, but I'm going to kick off with you, Andy, and say, despite those numbers, you know, it's expected to grow, but how prevalent are these issues in your opinion?
There's a lot to unpack in that.
Yes.
There's many topics referred to in that article that are worth discussing and digging into a little bit more deeply. I think, you know, they fall into sort of three buckets, right? Privacy, organization, whether that's on the retailer side or, you know, on the advertiser side. And then the relationships that advertisers are having with retailers and maybe how those correspond to the types of relationships they would expect with more traditional publishers. So there's a lot to unpack. I think if we start with privacy, in the US, right, that, you know, in EMEA, we're used to privacy regulation. There's more coming in across the pond. I think that what organizations will be asking themselves is how do we create like strategies that are scalable? So how do we create blanket, blanket rules that meet the requirements of like the strictest state that I can apply to every state. I think that's probably what we're going to see. But I think at a higher level, one of the benefits of retail media is that it is more privacy safe, right? It is utilizing first party data, permissioned customers, and giving advertisers a higher degree of like privacy safe environment. So I think that, I was actually surprised at that number, that's the biggest concern, quite frankly, because what we're hearing, I mean, certainly in the UK, but also from my colleagues in the US, is that some of the other topics that are referenced in this article about measurement, the relationship with the retailer, the quality of service that are being received, that's actually more prevalent in the conversations we're hearing.
Right.
I think privacy, yeah, it's something that, of course, every advertiser, every retailer takes very seriously. I think actually, like the opt-in rate that retailers are able to achieve is really, really important in terms of the onward service that they're providing to the advertisers. So, I mean, we're seeing, you know, different retailers present privacy and consent choices differently to consumers, and that's, you know, instructive of their onward retail media offering success.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that, I mean, that's my views on the privacy piece anyway. I'm not sure, Rachel, if you've got any.
So there's loads of really interesting things in that. I mean, when I read the article and sort of did a little bit of additional research, I was really asking myself, is it actually the privacy element of how data is being used that these retailers are concerned about, or is it rather the complexity of everything associated with privacy and data use and application that is making them feel concerned? I mean, you know, impossible to know because we're not there to ask these specific, you know, people that were surveyed any of those follow-up questions. But I wondered because, like you said, I'm not surprised to hear that retailers have high opt-in rates because they would be – that transaction between customer and retailer is often very brand-oriented and brand-led, and that brand loyalty is the thing that will you know, make people opt in effectively and certainly trust where their data is going. So I'd have thought retailers would feel like they've got a good grip on data privacy from the perspective of the data that they own. Maybe it's more to do with how that data is used and applied in order to get some results from a retail media point of view and from an advertising point of view that they feel less confident of. I don't know. I also wondered if, because just when you take into account some of the other statistics there, that AMS went through, I wondered if it wasn't just a sort of a general tale of a bit of mistrust going on here. It's as though I felt that respondents were trying to say through the answers in the survey, yeah, retail media is a huge opportunity, and but we've got some concerns, and the concerns are associated with the relationship that we've got with our partners. So maybe that means from a data point of view, it's less about data privacy, more about data use. Maybe they don't feel that they're getting the right data, back from their partners. Maybe they feel as though that relationship when it comes to use and application and gathering of data with their partners isn't what it should be. I don't know. You said you wanted to mention some things about relationships as well.
No, I think it's a really important point. And you're right, there's a sort of perception right now that a lot of advertisers are sort of like testing retail media and they want to invest and they see the benefits, but they're still, you know, maybe holding back from what actually the big potential is to reach these big numbers. I think the first thing to remember is the complexity of the retailer supplier relationship.
Yeah,
right.
Good point.
These are historically these relationships have been built around negotiations, right, and have built around retailers and suppliers having a very transactional relationship. But now retailers are providing a service to these advertisers. They're having to provide them with a high level of service, and they're actually like competing with other digital advertising channels, but they're not digital advertising organizations, right? So what I think as a sort of collective within the industry, what we're trying to achieve is like finding a connection between how buyers want to buy media, right, but also like taking into account how retailers wish to sell, taking into account like the nuance of what it is to be a retailer.
Yep.
Right. You know, traditionally, you know, what we're seeing today is that a lot of trade investments, right, that already exist between, you know, brands and retailers are being delivered via like retail media, in inverted commas, technologies, right? And what that means is that we're trying to now like move on from just a pure like, hey, trade delivery. We're actually thinking, hey, how can we get brand and agency and like budgets unlocked, through the same channels, right? So I think measurement is a really important part of that. We're hearing certainly from agencies, and not only are we hearing from them, we're actually doing a lot of work at Criteo with like IAB and ISBA to create like more standardization for advertisers to just make them feel more confident because confident, as you say, Rachel, like confidence is what it's about, and that drives reinvestment. I think some of the four areas that I want to just highlight that advertisers we believe would benefit from greater standardization is around like metrics, right? The naming conventions around the metrics that relate to the success of retail media. And the big difference of retail media and traditional media is this concept of a SKU, a product that underpins it. Right. The second one is around like the definitions of those metrics. Thirdly is like incrementality reporting. How do we define incrementality? Because that's actually what matters. And then finally it's attribution modeling. And different advertisers have different attribution like requirements, and it's imperative that retailers can provide flexible attribution, right, depending on the needs of the advertiser. So these are all ways that we can, as an industry, and as Criteo, as like a facilitator, like build more trust between retailers and advertisers.
Yeah, I think it's key. There is a lot there. That measurement piece and the metrics, how you kind of standardize those is going to be tricky. I think also this is kind of general statistics, helpful, but what type of retailers are we talking about? What products are they selling?
Exactly.
Are they, you know, it's very different if I'm selling soap once a month to, I don't know, cereal once a week, depending on, you know, my consumption habits, or if I'm buying a pair of sunglasses. I got this morning, I got an email from Ray-Ban saying, "Hi, Emery, it's been 6 months." So it's been 6 months since I bought, I think, directly off their site. I don't know if I did, but they've got my details. Am I looking to purchase a new pair of sunglasses now in the middle of winter in the UK? No, but what data do they have and what are they trying to achieve? Whereas if I bought that through another medium, what consent would I be willing to give and why? And what was the urgency behind my purchase as to what information I'm willing to share and how they build that picture around? And also alluding to, going back to your point about traditional retailers, the point of sale, what they did, you know, the negotiations that you referred to. If I was Nestle and I wanted to sell Kit Kats and I wanted to be at the end of the aisle, or I wanted to be on a premium shelf, it's very different now if I'm on Sainsbury's site or Coles or Walmart or whatever, what my positioning, how I'm negotiating, what the purchase habits are, or how they track it back. It's completely different. And I think that goes back into what we were talking about. You know, I'm keen to get a little bit more insight from both of you, if you can, around how can retail media partners and marketers collaborate to resolve them on top of these kind of initiatives that you talked about. Is there anything else that you think could be interesting for our listeners to be aware of when they're moving into the space, or rather than test budgets, or the different partners that they work with, who are the kind of key stakeholders that need to be involved to help with that educational piece?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things that I thought when I was reading this article is that, again, it was a little bit similarly to, you know, to what I mentioned earlier on with respect to data. I felt as though it was a story of those surveyed saying they didn't have a great deal of trust in their tech partners. And if that's true, then obviously that's a huge issue. You know, it's interesting to hear, Andy, what you guys are planning at Criteo to kind of plug those gaps. But what was also interesting was that they were specifically saying they felt as though those partners were letting them down in terms of meeting the challenges that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So it sounds as though there isn't enough perhaps customization and tailoring going on here from a tech point of view. Like you've just said, both of you, you've just spoken, you know, in a bit of detail to the complexity of that retail media piece. Maybe part of the problem at the moment is that the technology solutions that are available are focusing more explicitly on just one individual solution, or on one part of the, you know, supply chain, the advertising value chain. Maybe what we need to see is a little bit more nuance. We need to see some of these, you know, especially for ad tech partners and martech partners that we've been, you know, talking about retail media being a huge opportunity from a technology point of view. Maybe some of those players need to actually, you know, get a bit closer to retailers' businesses and understand how important that retail media offering is and what specifically it would take to overcome some of those technological challenges which are associated, frankly, with some of the fundamental issues that the advertising marketing industry is still dealing with, right? Measurement, attribution, you know, and the list goes on. For retailers, it includes, you know, product management, you know, all of the infrastructure issues and challenges that are associated with that, and those sorts of challenges from a tech point of view are not in the wheelhouse of ad tech and martech vendors. So maybe it's about some of those ad tech and martech solutions getting a little bit more nuanced in their understanding of the industry so that they can actually try to address some of those challenges that are coming forward from retailers.
Yeah, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, which is that there's a dissonance between what advertisers are asking for, which is standardization, and the reality that every retail business is different. And as a tech provider, right, you've got a choice. Hey, do we create a technology and a proposition that's more supply focused to address the needs of the retailer, or do you maybe create something more demand focused? Mm. Right, at Criteo, like, we're pretty clear we need to do both, right? Because that's the only way to connect the industry. And that's our job, is to connect the industry. And that's the only way that, you know, some of these big numbers can be reached, if the technology, as you say, like facilitates the transactions that both parties require. So on the supply side, so if we look at what retailers need, I think, first of all, every retailer has a different view or sense. And I'm talking specifically here about like on-site digital, like media on mm-hmm. their website. So like sponsored products, display advertising, right? And this is the high margin stuff that they want to leverage and maximize. Each retailer will have a different view as to, hey, I'm comfortable having three ad slots for sponsored products, whereas another retailer might say, I want one, right? These are like fundamental differences in the inventory that's available and buyable, like the viewability of the display placements. These are all things that create inherent differences between the offerings that retailers are bringing to the table. So, you know, as part of, as what we do at Criteo, we say, great, here's some technology, but hey, we can also provide you with benchmarks and like consultancy on like essentially how you should best set up your media offering to advertisers. Then the other thing is around like what additional first party data can they bring to the table? You know, we facilitate like targeting capabilities within our platform for advertisers, but then each retailer comes to the table with their own additional first party data sets which can add value to their offering. So, you know, we need to cater for like the differences in the needs of each retailer. Yep. Some may be far more aggressive, right, in their advertising approach, some less so, but you know, they've all got a right to that, and it's their business, and these are it's their audience, and ultimately they have a customer proposition, right, that for them is paramount and king. Mm. And advertising needs to respect that and form a really like native part of that. So that's kind of on the supply side what we need to cater for. And then on the demand side, it goes back to everything we just talked about. Advertisers need like standardization. They need the ability to buy like seamlessly across multiple retailers. And that's the feedback we're getting in the market. And that's why, you know, we want to provide that and do provide that capability to brands and agencies in the market to create more consistency, to create more trust. And yeah, I think that summarizes the kind of technology approach.
Yeah. Sounds easy, right?
Yeah, easy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's easy. Let's move on to the next story. Yeah. Again, we're keeping on the theme of retail media today. So this is about Kroger and Albertsons union could shake up U.S. retail media. So for international listeners, the U.S. supermarket Kroger is set to merge with Albertsons after offering to buy its competitor for $24.6 billion U.S. dollars. If successful, the tie-up could disrupt the U.S. retail media landscape, which is currently dominated by global juggernaut Amazon, with Walmart in second spot. Whilst Albertsons only launched their retail media offering last November, Kroger made their debut into the retail media space with the acquisition of dunnhumby USA in 2015. This was followed by the launch of its precision marketing arm in 2017, which delivers targeted ads across apps and websites. So very much in line with what you've just been outlining as more traditional there, John, in terms of display, etc. In a statement, the two companies said that the merged entity will be able to reach an expanded national audience of approximately 85 million households nationwide. However, U.S. senators have expressed concern over the impact the deal could have on the market competition. The companies have attempted to ease these fears by announcing plans for an Albertsons subsidiary called SpinCo, though it's unclear whether this will be enough to prevent further scrutiny. Right, Rachel, I'm going to come to you on this one, nice and easy. What impact could this merger have on the retail media space if it's successful, do you think?
Really feel like Andy should be answering this. Oh, I don't even know. I'm going to give it a go. But I won't steal his thunder. I'll let him come in with some pearls of wisdom there. Firstly, we were giggling at the notion of spinning out a holding company called SpinCo. I mean, great. There's so many.
It says on the tin.
Exactly. There's so many businesses that would have wanted that name for their holdco. What do I think this is going to do to the sort of retail media landscape? Well, it's for the time being anyway, quite a US focused story, right? This is something that's happening between retailers in the US, but mm-hmm. of course it could become, you know, who knows where this could go beyond that. I think that there seems to be some really obvious upsides on it from a retail media point of view in bringing together those two major supermarkets. supermarkets and all of the physical assets they've got, combined with that pool of customers and the potential data assets that they'll have across those two supermarkets. Mm-hmm. I found the physical store element of this news piece really interesting, right? So they were saying that I think it's particularly like between the two of them, they've got physical supermarkets, gas stations, pharmacies and distribution centres.
Manufacturing plants, don't forget, 52 of those bad boys.
There we go, like which is enormous physical footprint mm-hmm. and would apparently surpass the physical footprint of Walmart, who is yep. the next biggest retail media giant in the US after Amazon. So I thought that sounded really interesting because if they could do something to, you know, to sort of combine their offline physical, you know, purchasing and data together with some online activity, that gives them a potential real edge over their nearest competitors. But I think it's also really interesting, even just from a physical shopping point of view, right? Don't know about you guys, but I think the world of online shopping is certainly making physical in-store shopping more interesting. And I just think that if you're, again, living somewhere in the US where maybe your lifestyle is not necessarily focused on online shopping all the time, you're still physically going to malls and supermarkets and you're, you know, getting gas at the gas station on the way to or from or whatever, if all of those transactions are made more seamless, easier, if there's something to incentivize you to do all of them in the same place or to do them with the same retailer in a different way, I think that starts making stuff really interesting, right? And surely they've got their eye on what that might look like. The other thing that I thought about this just really briefly, because I know Andy's got loads
to offer
here.
For someone that wasn't wanting to kick off, you're doing quite well.
Yeah, just getting it all out while I can still remember it.
I'm holding back.
The anti-competition edge, I thought, a sort of angle I thought was really interesting. It is a huge deal. It would make it the biggest deal or one of the biggest deals in US supermarket history. $24.6 billion is a phenomenal amount of money. Really interested in what that would do to the customer experience. That's important from a retail media point of view because that customer experience is obviously not just on physical and in-store, it's also online. And, you know, if it means that there's less of a range of products to sell or that it's not as satisfying a customer experience, they will go elsewhere. We all know that. There's plenty of competition that can satisfy their needs. Your turn, Andy.
No, you've said a lot there.
And
again, no, not at all. And I'm going to try to unpack some of the themes that you talked through there. I think first, like reading about the, you know, potential merger in the ad tech press, it's being positioned as like a retail media ad tech play, right? But I think what you said is really interesting. It's not just that, right? There's the physical footprint and the synergy between Albertsons and Kroger, mm-hmm. it's a really good match, right? I think Albertsons has a bigger presence or preference among consumers in the Northwest of America, Kroger in the Southeast. So there's some geographical logic to it.
Yep.
You're right, anti-competition, that essentially like looms over the prospect of the merger, like a sort of spectre, right? And as we've seen, you know, through many of these potential mergers, it can just not happen, right? But what happens in the meantime, right? And how long is that process going to take? I think I read a really interesting article from an ex-Asda employee reflecting on the potential merger between Asda and Sainsbury's in 2018-19, right? Which is a lot of parallels to what we're seeing over
Absolutely,
in the US.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the feedback here is that a lot of what he wrote about is that this creates like unease across the organization, mm-hmm. right? At store level, but across all the functions, right? There's people actually like, what does my future look like? What is the organization going to look like? And that sort of trickles down into each area. Now, I think I agree with what is being said about the benefits of joining up these two organizations from a data perspective and creating a bigger like retail media powerhouse. I think it's absolutely the case. And, you know, we're seeing that the retailers with the most highly adopted loyalty programs will be able to pour in the most amount of, you know, activationable. Is that a word? Activationable?
It is now. I was going to say, you've just made it one.
Yeah,
nice.
I've created a word.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, here we go. There we go. But, you know, I think like Asda have done an amazing job in the last few months launching Asda Rewards, right, their loyalty brand. And that's a data play. And that's going to like pour fuel into their retail media business, and it's going to give advertisers so much more options. And I think seeing Kroger and Albertson come together is going to have an equivalent effect, right, with their respective loyalty and programs that they are running. So
indeed, because Kroger's got a really strong one actually, haven't they? Yeah, and exactly. Of course they purchased Dunnambi, you know, back in 2015, and have been running that data for a long time now.
Exactly. And obviously Albertsons launched the Albertsons Media Collective in November 2021. So again, they're also making their retail media play. And I think the final point I'd like to make on this is around, and it goes back to the fact that, you know, inherently with mergers, there's a move to consolidate, right? And particularly around technology, right? And we know that they're, and if we look specifically at the technology through the lens of retail media, they both have their respective stack and partners. So like, how does that all come together, right? While they're figuring out that, like, merger of technology and like proposition to the advertising market, which they're going to have to go through and do, their competitors, right, are going to be able to just continue pressing on, continue gaining ground. So, you know, yes, it's the long-term story is amazing, but what the risk to them is that actually it's going to impact them in the short term through lack of focus and through, you know, the complexity of tying together two disparate propositions. So, yeah, that's my general take on it.
That's a really interesting point, though, isn't it? Because, you know, from a sort of logistics perspective, what must that be like, trying to bring those two organisations together that, as you really interestingly pointed out, Andy, have got a bit of a different presence in different parts of the country.
Yep.
So would that make it easier in a way, or what would we find? Would we find that you know, that those shoppers that are regulars at Kroger down in the southeast or southwest, whichever it was, southeast, suddenly finding that, you know, their offerings are dwindling a little bit and they can't quite work out why? What the hell's happened to my favourite supermarket? It's not looking as good as it used to. Oh, this is annoying me. I'm now going to go and shop in Walmart. I'm now going to go and shop somewhere else altogether. And so they lose those customers. Whereas here in the UK, where things, just as an example, where things are, a lot less, well, they are a bit regionalised, but not as much perhaps as in the US. Would you notice so much if your Tesco's and Sainos were merging as a customer? What difference would that make to your day-to-day shopping activity?
As a price-based customer, price-sensitive customer, I would definitely be all over it.
Would you?
I'm aware of Co-op and what they're doing in Morrisons and selling and stuff. But what my sinister view around this is the point around how US senators have expressed concerns over the impact. When you started talking about it from a regional perspective, something went ding in my brain, kind of went, right, is this politically driven? Then you went on to talk about, what does this mean as an employee in the future? What does that look like for me? And I'd love some journalists to kind of dig deeper into this and kind of go, what's actually driving the pushback on this? Is it really market competition? Or is it that Kroger sponsored my little Jimmy's local baseball team and I've got a lot more stake in the game, and what that means, and what logistic companies and what the pharmaceutical companies mean, and where they have stake and where their employments, and which senator is up against whatever senator. My US politics isn't brilliant. In fact, politics right now is off the agenda based in London. But that's kind of what's making me think. And then it goes on to the loyalty. If we're in, you know, you're right, the kind of market share that they will continue to take whilst the others are building up, what is the long-term effect on that? Because if I am based in the middle of nowhere and I'm used to collecting my coupons from my local
Albertsons or Kroger's or whatever, and suddenly they're not available,
and I'm not, you know, IT proficient, I'm of a certain age or demographic, or for whatever reasons, it's habitual. That's changing for me. And what does that impact have? And then you try and translate that into the stack and the insights and the customer loyalty programs, and marrying all those different assets, be it, you know, from manufacturing to the pharmaceutical side, how can we even look at that? We've got no idea. We can't sell drugs online over here. That's a huge market. They're legal drugs. I mean, there probably is dark web for other drugs. I don't know.
I'm not sure, but if the Germany online illegal drug market is
Germany
that easy
are legalizing to enter. Weed to a certain, I read this morning. So, I mean, if the Germans are on it, surely it's all okay. But no, from a serious perspective, there's just so much to try and consume that we have no idea.
And also, too, one thing I thought about, and just listening to the both of you, you know, raise the interesting points you've made, I actually think, especially supermarket shopping, is quite emotional for most people, especially these. I mean, it's essential, right? Food's essential and it's part of your ritual. And I think it's becoming more emotional these days because it's really expensive. Life's really expensive, right? And people are going into supermarkets, getting annoyed, discovering that stuff's gone up, what stuff's been doubled in price, yep. or depending on who your retailer is. So actually, I think those shoppers and those customers are a lot more brand loyal and therefore brand sensitive than you imagine. But I'm quite sure people that you don't reckon?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I'm quite unique. And I remember a few years back, Rachel and I talking on a podcast of my highlight of COVID was going standing in a car park waiting to get to the supermarket. You know, that was just the highlight of my week.
But I think that was everyone's highlight, right?
But this kind of, why don't you shop online? Because I actually like to go up and down the aisles and look and see. And I like that challenge of, no, you can move it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're going to buy anymore. You know, test me all you like.
It's a form of meditation being in store.
It is.
You know, being walking up and down that aisle.
Yeah.
But no, I think retailers, certainly in the UK, they have a sort of place in the public consciousness. Like that, you know, they're what they represent as brands
exactly.
is really important. Mm. And, you know, obviously we know less about that the equivalent in the US, but we can imagine it's the same, right? And that local market, the experience of that shopper in the local market is really important, and I'm sure will play into whether this actually goes through or not.
Yeah.
I hope so. Because at the end of the day, it is about the customer.
Indeed.
It's supposed to be, anyway.
I mean, it's about making loads of money out of the customer.
Exactly.
Yeah, to benefit
whether
the customer.
Whether or not they can afford their,
to benefit the customer.
Their lights to cook the food or whatever, the electricity to cook. anyway, again, we digress. Okay, let's crack on to the third story. Here we go again. Walmart's launching a new creator-founder e-commerce platform. Right. American retailer Walmart has moved further into e-commerce by launching Walmart Creator, a new platform allowing the retailer to collaborate directly with influencers. Walmart Creator will give partnered creators and influencers access to tens of thousands of products, according to the company. Influencers will be able to share links to Walmart products to any social media platform or group, be recommended products based on their interests, and receive performance data to help grow their followings. Partners would also be able to earn revenue, all while earning commission on sales they refer, with no cap. By launching Walmart Creator, the company hopes to help fuel inspiration for our customers by connecting their favorite creators directly with our brand and the brands they love at Walmart. That's according to the Chief Marketing Officer, William White. Now, the beta version of Walmart Creator will launch in autumn 2022, with the platform going fully live in 2023. Andy, prepare yourself. I'm coming to you now.
Wow.
Do you think the launch of Walmart Creator signals a larger move towards embracing social commerce?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, I do.
And how might Walmart creators impact influencer marketing on a kind of wider scale?
So I think in Europe, the US, we're looking at the Asian markets thinking, hey, how can we replicate social shopping, right? How can we tap into that undeniable volume, live streams? And I think this is an important play into that world that Walmart are making. I think my take on it is, hey, how and when is this going to be an integrated facet of the Walmart advertising proposition, Walmart Connect? Because, you know, that's because I'm quite biased towards looking at things from a retail media perspective. But I think that this is a really like exciting move, and I would expect UK retailers to be following this type of model. But it's not new, right? Mm. I think, you know, Asda have been doing, I've been talking a lot about Asda because Asda are great. But
earning commission as well, yeah. Can't you?
But, you know, I think back in 2015, they were doing like co-funded like YouTube campaigns, right, with influencers and but there was actually like brand funded, right? So this isn't new, but I think what's interesting is that Walmart they're investing in this, right? And they're making it like measurable. And I think, again, to go back to our previous point, it's like, how do you actually create measurement that actually creates re-engagement and the ability to like scale? So I think it's a really interesting move. And I think the other retailer in Europe that I'd like to mention on this is Zalando. Obviously, Zalando Marketing Services is its own sort of standalone retail media arm. One component of their offering is Zalando Collabory, which is actually, again, like baked into their retail media UI and platform, is the ability as an advertiser, so as Nike, I can go in and I can set up my campaign, and then I can like opt to select like influencers to actually like participate and to promote my products in various channels, whether it's on-site, off-site. So I think this is reflective of the direction that the market is going in. There's going to be so many different ways that it can be like brought to life and brought to market. Walmart are doing it one way, but I think it's going to happen more and more, and I'm excited to see how we can actually interpret this in the UK.
Interesting, Rachel.
You're going to be setting up your Walmart creator account, Andy, and
I might have already done so.
Nice. Yeah. Got the beta version.
Exactly.
I think this is really interesting from the point of view of sort of Walmart trying to engage, creators who are potentially customers, who are also potentially, social media users in a kind of unified way. You know, I think it's a really interesting concept and idea. I like the way that they're pitching it as an opportunity for creators to make money, to make revenue, and that they're also putting it all under the label of, you know, anyone can be a creator. I quite like the idea that, you know, even just as a shopper, you could be snapping photographs of yourselves or taking little videos of the way that you use products and then posting them on social media, and you could be considered a creator, and you might even be able to make some money out of that, right? But where it actually links into the advertising offering and the advertising platform, as you raised, Andy, is not clarified, right? So what exactly are they going to do with this product? Obviously, you know, it's test and learn phase to start with. How are they going to then, I suppose, you know, they want to see how popular this becomes. If it does become really popular, what's the advertising angle going to be? And that will be really interesting to see.
How are they going to control it?
So you'll have to have an account. So,
but if I'm Kanye West, and I go in and I create one,
I think you might not get an account.
This is what I'm.
I know, you know, but I think you might not. If you were actually Kanye West, I think they might not let you set one
I'm
up.
Free. But I'm wearing Adidas today, but.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I imagine, I don't know the answer to those questions, but I imagine that they're going to be, you know, monitoring these accounts in exactly the same way that they would with any other creator accounts that they'll be using for advertising and for social media purposes.
Yeah,
the
so
only
I
difference
didn't
is the idea is that, you know, they're encouraging a wider pool of creators. So these are not necessarily professional influencers. They could be anyone.
Things just jump to mind, like, brand suitability. Look at the issues that publishers have faced.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
Traditional publishers.
Yeah.
Fake news.
Yep.
It's just to me. There's a. I don't mean to be negative about it, but it's just.
No, there's a brand safety angle to it.
For sure. And you would imagine that, you know, they're going to have to apply certain levels of control and verification over the content to make sure that it's real, etc. Yeah.
And where does it go to? You know, what if they're resellers? What about? For want of a better description, words fail me, knockoff world. You know, the when it comes to clothing, fake handbags, etc.
Yeah.
You know, the redirects and where, you know, where's the kind of authenticity level here? Maybe then it goes into blockchain.
There's also space for quite a lot of comedic content, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there can be quite a lot of comedy drawn from this. A lot of
hopefully,
you know, some quite amusing product demos. Yeah, that
definitely
infiltrate the main. You know,
and yeah, definitely.
Less of this big, massive, huge budget making this perfectly slick video. Right, perfume comes to mind. Christmas. Mm. It's only something advertised perfume. Why do you have to have some model?
Yeah.
It's like how many years in they could be a little bit more creative, and you could have that's. There's an opportunity. You can have that one free.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting point, right? Because the thing that I was thinking about with respect to live commerce, the live commerce opportunity, which is what they're presumably trying to create a gateway to, is that, you know, I think we mentioned it on a podcast a few weeks ago. Certainly we talked about it on stage as well at ATS Singapore when we were in Asia recently. The results coming out of the live commerce industry, its growth and its penetration in China, some research reports associated with that suggested that actually brands saw much higher volumes of sales off the back of non-professionalised videos. Now, when I say non-professionalised, I don't mean they were literally just rubbish videos. I just mean they weren't using celebrities or social media influencers. They were using product specialists, and the product specialist could be someone that actually works for said product company and, I suppose the digital version of the person on the makeup counter at Lancome in a department store who actually knows and understands about the product and can talk you through
other
how to use
are
it
available.
And stuff. but it could be that, from that to people that have bought it and are, and are unboxing it and showing you how you can use it and apply it and all the rest of it. And that those generated higher amounts of sales than famous people and influencers did, which I found really interesting.
And the money going back to the original creators, like you said, those genuine advocates of the product that are having fun or sharing their delight, enjoyment of whatever they're doing or using or purchased.
But I think, as Andy mentioned, I think this is definitely a clear attempt, here in Western markets to get on board the live commerce train and see if we can learn something from our Asian counterparts.
Indeed.
And I've always imagined that it would look different here anyway, right? The way that we interact with video content is completely different in Westernized cultures as it is in Asian cultures. But
yeah, absolutely.
It'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
I'm keen, actually, Andy, to come back to you on this. We've spent a lot of time discussing news from the US predominantly. I'd like to kind of get more of an update from you, what's going on at Criteo, kind of in the retail media area here in the UK or even Europe. You've touched upon Europe a little bit. Is there any more that you can kind of dig into?
Absolutely. Yeah, I like talking about retail media in the UK. So it's a good question. I think there's two levels, right? There's the buzz around it, and then there's what's happening, right? And they're very different things. What we're seeing is like retailers are doubling down on this, and it's retail media is becoming a more important board level topic at major retailers. That's an undeniable fact. It's getting a lot more airtime, and it means that retailers are identifying and observing the opportunity, right? There's, a ton of different consultants have done measurements around what the worth of the market will be in X number of years. And I think that they're all valid. But again, it's all about execution, as we talked about at the beginning, right? The challenges that they're seeing in the US are, fairly similar to the challenges they're seeing in the UK. Mm. I think what we're observing, and I was talking to a partner of ours yesterday, Shopper Media Group, about this, and they shared some really interesting insights from their view of kind of UK, Europe maturity versus US. I think it's generally accepted that the US are a couple of years ahead when it comes to retail media. They've got more retailers that are already doing billions plus in ad revenue. We're not there yet in the UK, but what we're doing, what we're seeing is, I think, more joined up approaches to retail media. And what I mean by that is retail media activity that's activated across more channels in a cohesive way. I think one of the challenges retail media has in terms of providing clear measurement, an actionable measurement to advertisers, the fact that a lot of the activations are quite siloed, right? You've got some activity in store, in screens, you've got some social activity via the retailer, you've got sponsored product activity. How do we tie them all together in a meaningful way? And actually, I think UK retailers are doing a pretty good job there right now. We look at Tesco last year, they launched, they announced the launch of Tesco Media and Insight powered by Dunnhumby. That was a big move. I mean, it wasn't, in my view, they were already doing a lot of that stuff already, but it was more of the sort of announcement to the market, which was interesting, I think.
And how they articulate what they're actually doing, I think there's maybe a little bit of a disconnect there.
Exactly, yeah. And I think Nectar 360 are doing loads of great stuff right now, all around the Nectar loyalty data, right? And I think they're growing, investing a lot around like off-site activations, because again, I talked earlier a lot about on-site and the media and the imagery that's available on the retailer property, right? Which is the highest margin stuff. But then, off-site activations, which is lower margin for the retailer, can be more strategic for the advertiser, right? And actually can address the needs of more advertisers and move and then label retailers to move up the funnel and get more sort of branding awareness budgets.
Can you give us an example of that?
Of what, off-site?
The off-site, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Please.
So I would describe Offsite as being an advertiser-funded ad served to a consumer on a non-retailer property. So I'll explain it a little bit clearer. So Coca-Cola wished to target the Asda audience off the Asda website.
Yep.
Okay, there'll be an ad, a display ad, let's say, on the Guardian website.
Yep.
And it'll be, let's say, co-branded Coke, buy the latest Coke
offer
on Asda. Customer clicks and navigates back to the Asda site.
Yep.
And completes the purchase, right?
Okay.
And often what Coke or any other, you know, advertiser would do, what they want to do is build like a campaign that is consistent throughout the customer journey. So the messaging that the consumer is seeing across the open web or in social channels or on connected TV is consistent to the messaging and the experience that they see when they then hit the Asda website.
Yes.
Right? So then they can see a corresponding banner and they click and then they go to the product page. And that's where retail media is so powerful, right? Because it brings you to the point of conversion. And that's why Coca-Cola and others, and even nowadays, I wanted to chuck money in, because they can see, like, well, where better way to spend my money? Right? And that's why, back to macro, there's this shift of budget, right, from Google to Facebook into these retailer networks. And we're seeing that in the UK. You know, Asda, a big reason for them launching their loyalty program was the impact. Obviously, it's for the consumer. Like, don't get me wrong. That's
so they're a client, as opposed to you being an Asda avid shopper.
Bit of both, of course, naturally.
Of course.
But then, you know, Boots launched Boots Media Group last year, right? And that was a big play. Morrison's, again, very recently announced the launch of Morrison's Media Group, also in partnership with Shopper Media Group, who I mentioned. So, you know, there's lots
happening.
I'm
curious on the Morrison's front, just purely for full disclosure.
Yeah.
I was looking for some products last night and I was looking on Amazon, which could be delivered. Morrison's is my closest supermarket, and they happened to deliver said product. I then went onto Morrison's website to see if the price was the same, and it was cheaper on Morrison's website than it was through the discount that I was being offered on Amazon. So
That's an interesting experience.
It is, yeah.
Did you pass that on?
I haven't yet, because I then went onto Sainsbury's website to see if they'd have old products that I was looking for that I would just drive in my car and go over there because of convenience.
Yep.
And they had one product was cheaper on there than it was on Amazon. So, I mean, I haven't come to the end of this story yet, but I'll let you know where I'm coming in. But it just that description.
Making curry here is very complex.
No brand loyalty here.
No.
Completely price-driven and relevant.
Well, and convenience as well.
Slightly, but I was thinking, would all those packages arrive on Sunday as they say they would, but I don't trust Amazon anymore in their delivery, or is it better and more environmentally friendly for me to walk down to Morrison's and get it?
Or, on the topic of convenience.
Yeah.
Q-commerce, right? I mean,
Q-commerce.
Q-commerce. Let's talk Q-commerce.
Tell us about Q-commerce.
I mean, you know, Deliveroo announced the launch of, you know, Deliveroo Media and e-commerce. Uber making a play. You know, this profile of business is looking at ads as a fantastic way to, you know, sustain and grow their business. And we're seeing like a ton of interest there, but both by
from retailers.
So the Q-commerce, actually, Deliveroo
providers,
they wish to stand
for
up.
For our listeners, I'm assuming it's quick commerce, right?
It is,
it's just
absolutely. I think that's a good one to clarify. Q quick commerce, but no, the Q-commerce players themselves wish to stand up ads businesses, right? And they have. But what I'm really interested in seeing is the appetite among advertisers to invest in those new channels. And that's what's interesting. And yes, there's in the case of Deliveroo, there's an interesting additional dynamic, which is the fact that they're a marketplace, right?
Yes.
And they have Morrison's and Co-op, et cetera, as, you know, sellers, right, on their marketplace. So there's an additional kind of complexity there. But we're seeing that advertisers wish to invest in Q-commerce because that's where consumers are going. That's how customers are buying today. So that's certainly another trend that we're seeing. I've already talked about the new verticals, right, that that advertisers wish to invest on via retailer first-party data, right? And then I think the other important, interesting trend that we're seeing in UK retail, which actually follows a trend that we've seen in France initially, and also it's catching on the US, is the retailer marketplace. Okay, so retailers launching their own marketplaces, so replicating that sort of Amazon model of being able to massively expand their product selection at a lower cost base, right? And when you launch a marketplace, or when you have you know, even as a retailer, when you've got hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of suppliers, these are all potential participants in your advertising business. So one of the things that retailers are doing is not only, to go back to our earlier points, working on addressing the needs of global agencies and global brands and the big, big spenders, but also, hey, how can we create more streamlined self-service propositions for smaller advertisers, for marketplace sellers and for longer tail brands? So that's a really important growth area that we're seeing in the UK, but also in other markets. I think I've almost run out of things to say.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time.
Oh, we've run out of time. Well, that's good.
We have,
that's good timing.
Apologies, because I mean, we've only scratched the surface in some of these topics. Going to have to get you back in and dig deeper into this. It's been really interesting. So thank you for coming in, Andy.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been really good fun.
And Rachel, thank you as always for being a guest.
My pleasure.
And that's this week's podcast. Thank you, listeners.